Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Dave.
And we're the hosts of the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, where we bring you stories that delve into the science and spirit behind intriguing people doing extraordinary things.
Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. This week, it's episode 28. This week, I've got Jacob Pusey on the line. Now, where do I start about Jacob Pusey? Now, Jacob, if you ever follow him on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, the guy is one of the more incredible human beings you'll ever meet. Outside of being ruggedly handsome, he's also one of the greatest coaches, ultra endurance running coaches out there. And also in 2016, he broke the Guinness World Record for the fastest 50 mile on a treadmill. Now, Jacob has done incredible things with his running career, but you know, I just want to focus on this for a quick second because this just gives you a really good overview of this guy's athletic accomplishment. He ended up running 4 hours and 57 minutes and 45 seconds for 50 miles on a treadmill. That's averaging 5 minutes and 56 seconds per mile. And his marathon split was 2 hours and 38 minutes. And he ran a negative split to finish up the 50 miles. Now, I don't know about you guys, but those numbers, they blow me out of the water. This is absolutely incredible. And I'm so super, super stoked to have Jacob on the call. Now in 2020, we've had a really difficult, interesting, odd, strange, oddball year. And we all have our different endurance challenges that we're all struggling with. Now, Jacob, his brother is sick, Ribs. And yeah, Jacob has been going about his own endurance challenges this year. You know, I know Jacob to be a super strong man. And this year has had to be the strongest that he's ever had to be. So without further ado, welcome Jacob Pusey to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to be here.
It's awesome to have you. Yeah, we'll get to that. Breaking 5 hours for 50 miles on the treadmill.
Incredible.
Kind of thing in a minute. But, you know, as we like to do, which is to give everyone a context, because, you know, often those kinds of examples are somewhat intimidating, you know, mm-hmm. because, hey, look, this isn't for everyone. But I'm sure you have a good story as to how you got there. You know, were you a runner as a kid? Did you love it? Was it part of your life all throughout? Did you sort of early on dream of setting a Guinness World Book record? Or is it more of a more organic story? So yeah, we love hearing. Tell us a little bit about the Jacob story.
Well, I grew up in rural America. My parents were not the norm in the communities that I grew up in. Because unlike at least what I thought most of my friends' parents were like, they could care less about organized sports. Neither of them grew up playing sports. They didn't sign us up for t-ball or soccer or basketball. Football was king in rural America. And yeah, they could care less. We had a big family and we spent a lot of time outside and not necessarily organized play, like not even like organized hikes or backpacking so much as like, just like, it's probably that we just had a small house and a lot of kids. So we just spent a lot of time outside. And so I played a lot. I played hard and played rough. And so rode bikes, roller skated, played roller hockey. I didn't grow up in Canada, so I didn't actually learn how to ice skate until I moved to Canada 5 years ago. I don't even know how to downhill ski because I've spent so little time around that type of precipitation. So most of my life I've been able to run around shirtless and in short shorts or cutoffs or, you know, in barefoot kind of thing. So running, the way my brother describes it is running was kind of just like a lot of people stop and then they try and start as adults or something like that. And we just never really stopped. We just kind of made it a more formalized part of our lives. That's kind of how it worked.
Did you run in high school or in college or any of schooling?
Yeah, I eventually started running. I ran in middle school, but it wasn't because I wanted to run in middle school. I was trying to sign up. I eventually found basketball, and the way that our parents were was they would only let us play one organized sport a year because there were so many of us. They just said, there's only so much bandwidth. There's only so much time. Like, so each of you can focus on one. It wasn't like this at all costs, but it was just like, there's only so many parents and so many cars to get kids to and from different practices and stuff. So it was like,
right.
You two are playing soccer. You guys can play. You're doing piano lessons. You're doing whatever. It was just like, we couldn't all be doing something every single day. And so it was like,
and Jacob, how many kids were in the house? When you say so many of us, how many kids did you grow up with?
There were six kids in my home growing up. So we had a big family, and I'm the oldest of four boys and the second oldest child. I have an older sister. Mm-hmm. So we all grew up really, really close. I never had my own room until I moved off to go to college and stuff like that. It was just, I was roommates with and basically best friends with my siblings growing up. And so I played basketball, and that was what I chose to do through middle school and high school. And I wasn't allowed to play football. I mean, I was tiny. So part of it was just like, there's no way, like even with pads, we're not letting you do that. So I would sneak out and I would go to football practices of organized teams of like the coaches that I knew or my friends. And I'd try and play, but I didn't have the pads. So I play without pads and my jeans and stuff like that. So I wanted to play football, but I just wasn't allowed to like put on the pads and the uniform. I like soccer and stuff like that, but I didn't start running formally until middle school. And that was actually only because that was when my parents said, okay, you can get yourself to and from practice. And so I was allowed to do more than basketball. So I started playing tennis, and then I got kicked off the tennis team 2 years in a row. And so I decided to play basketball, or no, I'm sorry. I decided to sign up for track. Mm-hmm. And so,
why did you get kicked off the tennis team?
Apparently, okay, not,
can you tell that story?
Yeah, apparently you're not supposed to trash talk in tennis. It's a gentleman's sport, and I went from basketball to tennis, and I wasn't a gentleman in grade, I guess. But that was when Andre Agassi and John McEnroe, like, I mean, that was, right. The guys that you saw were mouthy guys, and so it was like, of course you're supposed to trash talk.
You just do what they do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and my role models, my parents didn't want them to be my role models, but my role models at the time were like Charles Barkley and Dennis Rodman, who were also
mouthy kind of guys.
So it was like, okay, I have little man syndrome. Like, I was like 4'11" and weighed 85 pounds. So it was like, I've got a mouth. I don't have a body, but I got a mouth. So I'm at least going to run my mouth. So. they kicked me off the tennis team, and I was signed up for track. I don't even know that I actually chose to. So I signed up for track, and then eventually signed up for cross country, and kind of bought into the idea of like, okay, maybe the best basketball player in our school at the time ran cross country. And so I was like, yeah, I want to be a better basketball player, so I might as well run cross country. And so I did.
Funny. Yeah. And did you do well?
Not really.
In high school? No.
In middle school, my goal for the first season was, even after practicing every single day after school, my goal was to finish a race without stopping and walking. So the races were like 1.5 to 2 miles or 3K. And my goal was to not walk by the end of the season. And so, I mean, I was a decent enough athlete that part of the reason I had to walk was because like I wanted to stick my nose in it. And so I'd like run up and try and run with the good athletes, and then I'd have to stop walking, and then I'd sprint to try and catch the leaders, and then stop and walk. So, I mean, I was competitive. I just didn't know how to pace myself. So, but I was probably like fifth on my team or in my class in a small town, in a small school. So that was middle school. And then, I finished my freshman year, grade 9 of high school, number 14 on the cross country team of a not very good team. And that was the last spot that got to run for the junior varsity team at the district championships. So I was the last guy on the JV team at districts. And I think I got dead last in that race too. And then something happened that winter and spring and summer. And I went from, I think three guys graduated, and I went from being number 14 on the team to number one on the team in the course of about 9 months.
Wow.
And that, I wasn't always the number one guy, but I was our most consistent, like,
mm-hmm.
So what I did hit puberty at some point along the lines there, but I think the biggest part was, I continued to play basketball that winter. And then I still ran in the mornings. One of the guys that joined the team at the same time as I did was a junior, was in grade 11 at the time, but he was a wrestler. And he had to cut weight all the time and stuff. And so, but we both just like, it was really weird. Like the our coach was amazing and the team was amazing and just the sport was amazing. It was just intoxicating. So I think we were 13 and 14 on the team, but he wrestled, I played basketball, and we met every morning at 5 a.m. and ran in the dark before school. Wow. And then we'd go to school, and then he'd go to wrestling practice, I'd go to basketball practice, and then track season started. And all of a sudden I was like worlds ahead of the kids who didn't play basketball and didn't run during the winter, including like the guys that were on the varsity team. And it was just like, not everyone, I was still like chipping away and trying to like make a spot to run the 3000 at the district meet and stuff like that. But then again, that summer I did the same thing. I woke up, lived in a really hot place in the summers. And so like 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. was dedicated to run so that I could work the rest of the day in the sun. And one of our school record holder came back from the University of Portland. He had graduated in 96 and I graduated in 2000. So we just missed each other, but he came home and he needed people to train with. And he asked anyone that would to train with him. And everyone was like, "Oh no, we're not worthy. We're not worthy." And I was like, "I'll hang as long as I can, man. You got to go 12 today. I'll go six with you. I will hang with right. you as long as I can."
And so was that the summer, very first?
Go ahead.
Sorry. Sorry. Was that the very first time in your life that you ever, cause you know, and Jacob, I know a lot about your training and your race methodology, and you're just all about hard work. I mean, you put in the work, you always have, and you always will. Is that the very first time in your life that you really, you know, gained, you know, all the benefits from all the hard work, and then you kind of put two and two together that, hey, if I want it, I just have to work hard for it.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, in the town that I grew up in, like my parents were, even though they're not like crazy educated, my parents were probably more educated than at least some of the kids that I grew up with. And so, we were pretty orthodox. Like we would wake up. It wasn't a foreign thing for me to wake up at 5 a.m. because I grew up waking up to read the King James version of the Bible before we'd go to school. So like when we do Shakespeare and stuff like that, that was a foreign language to rednecks. And I was like, I've been doing this since I was a little kid. Like I know that language. Like this, and then the other half of my class spoke Spanish, and so like school came pretty easy to me, in part because like I grew up around books, and we were expected to hold our own at the dinner table and stuff like that, and so like school was always easy, but that was mostly because of my upbringing. It wasn't because of any effort on my part. It was because of my parents. Whereas sport, even basketball, I mean, I wanted that so bad. I was that kid with the bloody knuckles. Like I cry when I go running, even in the winter, when I see kids out there in their backyards with their hockey sticks and their pucks and they're on their little court. And it's like, that was me. And that was me with the bloody knuckles, just like wouldn't go inside. Mom was saying, "Hey, it's time for dinner." It's like, okay, can I eat in 5 minutes and go back out? But I didn't ever see the fruits of that as a basketball player. But for the first time, like, when I saw that as a runner, it was just like, they weren't lying. Like you can actually like change your destiny if you just keep grinding. And so, I mean, there are certainly some pros and cons to that approach. It honestly took me like a decade to unlearn how to train the way I trained in high school, because like there were no easy days. There were, in college, I'd win every single run, and then I'd be like best, like fourth or fifth on our team on race day because I won the previous 5 days in a row. And everyone else was like, oh, we're taking our easy days easy, and then we're going to crush you on the weekend. And so it took me a while to like realize there was a difference between hard days and easy days and different intensities and stuff. So, yeah.
The best fall apart. So when you go through this process, you're sort of putting some effort in earnest. Was there a time where you sort of, you know, started to get this inkling that, yeah, I'm actually pretty fast. You know, I know you said you went to the sort of number one in the cross country team, but speed you're starting to run at that you ultimately get to. Did you then have a good training plan that got you there? So you were getting good return on whatever your genetics are and in effort and.
No, I honestly, that's not a knock on any of my coaches. I think I didn't really learn how to train until I started coaching other runners, honestly. Yeah. And I started coaching other runners. I mean, I did some volunteer coaching with kids when I was in high school. And then even as a college student, I volunteered and things. And I started kind of figuring things out when I was coaching the local high school. The school that I graduated from only had a cross country team. And so I coached at the local track for the local track team in the spring. And the school was about 5K down the road, maybe six anyway. So I would get done with class and just like sprint down the the highway and then meet the kids for workouts. And then I'd run with them and then I'd run back. And so not only was my volume pretty high, but I was getting in some quality and a lot of variety because I'd run in the mornings and then I'd run in the afternoons and it was pretty good. But I would also call my high school coach and my previous college coach and be like, man, these kids are like me. Like these kids are from like rural America. They will do whatever you ask them to do. They'll run through fire or brick wall if you ask them to. I don't want to mess these kids up. And so what do I need to do to not mess them up? And so they started explaining the methodology to me. And in some ways I was kind of, I was having to peel away the layers of what I hadn't listened to growing up. So it wasn't that people hadn't tried to teach me. It was just like, I grew up in a culture where like no pain, no gain kind of thing. And like, you know, it was ball sport mentality, mm-hmm. You know, like the same type of communities where kids die from dehydration because the coach won't let them get a glass of like drink water in the middle of football practice. So not a knock on like the people that I grew up with, but that's the place I grew up. So.
That's true.
It's intellectual dissonance is a hard thing to understand, right? You know, because it just feels like the more I work, the better I should do. Mm-hmm. But without any guidance, why would we think anything else, right? It just, it's an evolved thinking, really.
Yeah.
And even then, I don't know, you know, when I was doing some of my best training under a coach, he kept putting me in the zone two running. And I was in a race and I just wanted to wear a shirt that said, I'm not this slow. And, you know, but it was for a training purpose. And, you know, I ended up running pretty fast on other races, but because I did that. And so that it's not a high school thing, run slow to go fast. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I think we need to age a little bit to get that in our heads.
Yeah. And I do think that it was also like, I mean, I was more than a foot shorter than I am now. I weighed half as much as I do now. And so part of it was like in that same culture of like bigger is better. I was not big. Right. And therefore I had to like compensate for it even in the weight room in high school, it was like, even though I was half the size of the football players and baseball players, it was like, you're not going to tell me I can't lift with these guys. And so it's the same mentality. It's like, what you're looking for is a hernia. You're going to hurt yourself. But I didn't know any better. I just wanted to prove that I could do it. And so running became that equalizer, I guess, in a lot of ways for me.
Well, I think that, you know, too, having that guidance through either a coach or a mentor or somebody you look up to that, hey, you know, the hard days have to be harder and the easy days have to be easier. And you need recovery days and there are recovery runs and on and so forth. So Jacob, to jump forward, and we're going to get back to you, to your running career and on and so forth and the crazy treadmill stuff and 50Ks and 50 milers and on and so forth. But, you know, you're coaching right now. And you know, I know of a lot of your athletes are doing exceptionally well over the years. And talking to them, they tell me a lot about that same mentality that I really feel like I should be running more, but yet then they're performing on race day. And how do you argue with that? So, you know, is that something that you've really fine tuned in the last many years with your coaching, with you know, kind of the easy days need to be easy, the harder days need to be harder?
I try to do that. Like I try to practice what I preach. And I try not to totally paint myself into a corner though, either, in terms of like, this is my philosophy. Like there's a French term called bricolage, which is kind of just like bringing in the best of both worlds. It's not a hodgepodge, so to speak, but it's just being aware of all the philosophies that are out there and then trying to incorporate them. So I try to think of the way that I coach as like being based on principles and then tailoring it to the individual. And so like I do my best to like read everything that's out there from anyone who's done anything, whether it's an athlete or a coach or whatever, and try and be aware of the different systems and the different philosophies or approaches that are out there, because chances are when people come to me, they will have come from a different system. So whether it's the Hansons or the Hal Higdon or the Greg McMillan or whoever that is, Tin Man, whatever, there are a lot of different ways of thinking about training, Jack Daniels, and that can be before or after the run, but I'm just joking. But yeah, so there are a lot of different philosophies out there, and I really try to just understand where people are coming from so that I can meet them where they're at. And then usually if I can look and see what they're doing, I can say, okay, you either were adhering to this or you weren't. that's usually a problem if you're not even adhering to the system. But I usually kind of have an idea of, okay, what are some things that we can tweak, even just with what you're coming to me with, to fix that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm like low mileage or high mileage or whatever. It's just kind of, let's do what we can with the time that we have because of that stress and rest concept. So like what you do, I mean, you're an anomaly, Dave. Like you run way more than most people that I know, way more than most even like elite marathoners that are, you know, training, even the Japanese marathoners, you run a lot. And most people would come, I have had people come to me and say like, how does Dave Proctor run this much? I was like, I don't know, but he does, and it works. So that works for Dave, right. and it makes sense. Like there's, especially because it's not breaking you, it's building you. And so if that works and you both have the structures in place and you have the time and desire and ability to do the other things to support that, awesome. A lot of people that I work with are like, may say, hey, I've got less than 10 hours a day to dedicate, or not a day, a week. I have 8 hours a week to dedicate to training. So can you help me prepare to run a marathon? Yeah. Okay. Like exactly. What can we do with these 8 hours or these 10 hours? Or like most people don't have 20 hours or 40 hours a week to dedicate to training. And right. I'm not saying that you do either, but you know, but I try and just fit what we can into the spaces that we have. And so in a lot of ways, I'm more of a scheduler than a trainer. It's just kind of, okay, what can we do during the limited windows of time that we have to maximize our gains?
And so what are some of the principles then you use in coaching as you guide people? You know, what are like the foundations for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think stress and rest are huge. So, adequate stress plus adequate rest equals, you know, optimal progress. That's probably the biggest one. I definitely believe in aerobic development, and incremental adaptation to stress. And so, I think the long run, however you want to define that, should be the cornerstone of any sound training program. And so, you know, if people have 8 hours, two of those hours might be dedicated to a long run each week, you know? The long run's really important. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be a 7 week cycle though. It can be a 10 week, it can be a 2 week. We don't have to be stuck in this arbitrary system that is man-made, you know? And yeah, just really, individualizing that adaptation to change. So some people may do fine with one recovery day in between a hard workout and a long run, and and others need 2 or 3 days between that. And so really just respecting and listening to the body, kind of learning to be intuitive and adapt based on how your body's actually responding, and learning to listen to your body.
So Jacob, I love everything you're saying, and as a coach, you know, reaching out to your athletes and the adaptation model and the listening and on and so forth. But let's go back in time, because I know that there was one time in your life, in your running life, that you thought that, you know, you were going to be hanging your shoes up because of your reoccurring injuries and on and so forth. And until you tried a new pair of shoes that was on the market at that time. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that story?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a combination of stories. I took 2 years completely off. So my goal throughout high school was to get a scholarship to run. Like I said, I'm from a small family, single income for most of high school, at least. That traditional North American family, whatever that looks like, there was not enough money for my parents to pay for us to go to school. And especially as one of the oldest, like I still have 4 siblings at home. And so if I wanted to go to school, I was going to pay for it. And so I had 2 ways of doing that. Well, 3 ways. I could work, which I did from the time I was a little kid. I could get good grades, which I did. And I could run, which I did, but I needed to run well. And so my goal was to get a scholarship. I think I was offered a little bit of money at some of the really small regional schools, but I didn't accept those because the cost of living would have still been too high. So I received some academic scholarships, mostly academic and like service-based community scholarships. I walked on to the top junior college school in the country. And I met with the coach the year prior, and I was visiting my sister who was attending school, and I was like, hey, you know, I'd really like to walk on the team. And he's like, yeah, we won nationals this year. And, wow. If you have any aspirations of running in college, you should probably look elsewhere because you won't make this team. And so, I mean, being who I am, I was like, all right, see you next year. And so I showed up, and I, like everyone that he had already offered scholarships to, which was 9 guys from my class and another, I think 5 from the previous year's team, and, you know, 5 score in cross country. So it was like, hey, our returning 5 are coming back, and I'm giving 9 other scholarships to more deserving athletes, and, 7 travel. So they all got put up in dorms, and I camped in a tent by the lake, during practice, during tryout week. And, I think I placed 6th or 7th at the time trial at the end of the tryout week. And so he was embarrassed. Like, it was actually like one of the most vindicating experiences of my life was to see him like chewing out all the scholarship athletes that didn't train over the summer. Cause I went from sea level and had to do the time trial at 5K. And a lot of these kids were from the mountains and stuff like that.
Wow.
And this, you know, lowlander crushed them. And I felt pretty good about it. Like, I mean, I was heaving and couldn't breathe and felt like, yeah, I was going to be asthmatic for the next year, but I beat him. So,
but one of the greatest moments of your life. I love that. That's so
cool. It was awesome. Cause yeah, then he came over and he was he was embarrassed, and he was like eating crow almost, like, yeah, sorry, I told you you couldn't. And the coolest part was that next year we went, or that at the end of that fall, we went to nationals. 5 of the 7 guys on that team came from those 9 that, or no, no, I'm sorry, came, were non-scholarship athletes. So there were 5 guys on the team that were on, no, there were like 7 guys on the team that were on scholarship that were at home. Well, we traveled to nationals, won nationals, and those guys were getting at least their tuition covered, if not room and board and everything else. And I was not. So that was really cool, and really vindicating. I was on an academic scholarship, and I had to keep my grades up. And so, and I was taking a really heavy load because it was like, hey, you know, this is per semester, this is what you pay. So it was like, oh, minimum is I have to take 12 to be eligible. I'm going to take 20. And so I was both training really hard, trying to hang at altitude with these guys. I'm sure my diet was terrible. And then I, because they had meal plans. They got 3 meals a day paid for, and I was paying for my food, so I was not eating the way they were eating. And so anyway, by the end of the year, I was sleep deprived and just drained emotionally and physically and mentally, because I was probably sleeping 5 hours a day and running 100 miles a week and at altitude and not eating well. So by the end of the season, or by the end of the year, it was really weird. Like, he offered me a scholarship. He was like, "Hey, we want you to come back and you're on the team. Like, you maintained your travel spot. You scored points for the team. We want you back." I was like, "Wow, I don't know if I want to come back." Like, and it wasn't him. It was just like, I don't know if I can handle that again. Like, it was the moment I had been waiting for my whole life. And I was like, I don't even know if I like running anymore. Like, it was so weird that I was that exhausted and that burnt out. And I think at regionals that year at track, I ran the 1500, the 3000 meter steeplechase, and the 5K and the 10. No. I didn't run the steeple that day. I did the 15, 5, and 10 in like a span of like 12 hours. And then he offered me a scholarship, and I was like, and it was in like a rainstorm. I was like, I don't even like running anymore. This sucks. Like, it was really weird. So I was burnt out. And I took 2 years off to serve like a humanitarian mission in Latin America. And then I walked on to another team. Well, no, I didn't walk on. One of my teammates had transferred to another school. And I was offered a scholarship there. But I had gone 2 years without running. So I was like, yeah, I'll follow this guy and see. And it really took me like two more years. So like 4 years to like get my fire back. Of just like trying to get back into it and race. And it was what was supposed to be my senior year of college. I shattered my navicular bone. So I spent that year in a boot, running around, trying to cheer on my teammates and trying to ride next to them on a mountain bike with clipped in with my boot. And then one of my teammates, a guy that transferred at the end of that year, was a guy that was kind of a household name for my class in the US, at least one of the top guys ever, multi-time state champion. His name was Golden Harper. And I think he placed ninth in the country our senior year of high school, outkicking Alan Webb, oh. Of all people, like a sub 4 minute high school miler. So he was fast. And he was transferring from another school. I think he had kind of a similar experience. He had been a lot better and then was sort of burnt out and was like trying to finish out his collegiate career. And we were teammates, and little did I know, he had grown up in a shoe store that owned by his parents, and just hearing all the ideas from his dad. And I couldn't run and was told I'd probably never be able to run again. And was trying to get back to it with orthotics and stuff like that. And he started recommending getting in shoes that the orthotics would fit in, and then eventually weaning myself off the orthotics and getting into something that was much less, with a much lower drop. So at the time, that was when like Nike Shox and every other brand was essentially doing like the 4-to-1, like where you're at like a 45 degree angle. Yeah. So that's part of what led to my, I think the shattering of my navicular bone, just like, at least with my gait, it just like jammed everything, with every foot strike. And so as I lowered the heel in my shoes, and as that gradually healed with all sorts of therapy. I mean, I still feel it every once in a while. I mean, it's not still, I'm old and it still feel it. But I can, certain shoes I don't, and then other shoes I do. So I just avoid any shoe that makes me feel it. So anyway, so Golden Harper went on a few years later to, in the middle of a recession, we graduated, and it was like, it would be dumb for anyone to, sorry, that's one of my athletes and fellow coaches texting about a video that we're working on. So in the middle of the recession, a guy who had, he basically was set up to go back and manage his family's store and eventually become the owner. Instead, he took on $1 million loan and tried to take on the footwear industry and like, said, "Hey, I've got this idea. I'm gonna try and make shoes." And it was like, so I respected him as a runner, and I respected him as someone that helped me like get back to running healthily, but I didn't realize that he had it in him. Like he kind of came off as someone that was sort of used to having things. His dad had been his coach growing up and stuff like that. So he was kind of used to having things his way. And he was the only boy in his family and stuff like that. So, I mean, he wouldn't care that I was saying this. Like we weren't best buddies all the time. Like we didn't agree on everything. We were teammates and I was the leader, and then he showed up and it was kind of like, who's going to be the leader on the team? And my respect for him quadrupled exponentially. When he did what he did, not just that he created what he did, but just the balls that it takes to do that. Yeah. Like really in the middle of the deepest recession that anyone had experienced, like in generations, I'm going to take out $1 million loan that I can't repay and try and take on Nike and Adidas and all these people that told me I was stupid.
Right. Right.
Okay. Yeah. Like, so I gained a whole level of respect for him, and that company has since become Ultra.
Ultra. Yeah, absolutely. Ultra. And so, I think the three of us all run in them. You and Joe, you run in Ultras, don't you?
Sometimes, and then the Hoka as well. So a variety of that. They're great shoes. I think what's neat about them is they have sort of opened up a category that wasn't that common.
Right. Right.
A different kind of style. So now you're starting to make some progress. Are you seeing, you know, like this 50-mile world record in your head somewhere? Is it starting to develop, or is this like one night you're out having a beer and someone says, oh, I wonder how fast you could run 50 miles on a treadmill? How did it come together?
No, not at all. If someone had told me, I don't even know that I had trained on a, yeah, by that point I had run a little bit on a treadmill. But yeah, when I was in college, I think the only time I did run on a treadmill was this short window when I wasn't actually on a team. It was when I was preparing to transfer from the school that the junior college, and I was preparing to transfer. And I was actually trying to lose like 25 pounds of beans and rice and fried plantains that I had gained while in Panama. And so I was just, that was the first time I'd spent any time on a treadmill, was just like running 10 miles every morning before school, just to like run. That was my training plan, was just like, go run for an hour. That was it. And that actually was the lead up to my first marathon, but that was again, just like on a dare from a guy across the hall that was like, hey, do you want to run a marathon with me? Sure, let's do it. So that happened. And that kind of opened my eyes to like, whoa, hey, maybe if I quit trying to run the 1500 and start running the marathon, I might actually do okay. And I think I exceeded the expectations of my college coach at the time, the guy who told me not to try out for the team. because I had actually, he was an All-American, like he was an NCAA All-American in the steeplechase, like he was a good athlete, and he tried to run a couple marathons, and it's been cool because he has since reached out to me and said, hey, do you have any pointers for me? Because in my debut marathon, I ran faster than he ever ran, even though he was like a sub 9 3,000 meter steeplechaser. So he was legit, like 8:40 something. So I ran surprisingly well off of no structured training other than just like try and run as much as I can before and after school on a treadmill. And then I transferred and still had 3 more years of 8Ks and 10Ks of cross country in the mud. So I still wasn't tapping into that. But my plan was to eventually run a marathon. I ran a marathon a couple weeks or maybe a month after my final cross country race in college, and still kind of saw that promise. And actually kind of during that time, one of my physiology professors hooked me up to some machines and started testing for VO2 max and lactate threshold and stuff like that. And that's probably when I realized that perhaps as a result of the way that I trained, but also probably just because of genetics, I'm actually made to do this. And although I have some genetic predispositions to like, or some obstacles to overcome, I also have some like extremely freakish, like
VO2 max,
VO2 max and stuff. Yeah.
What is yours?
It's measured in the 80s a couple times, and and that's not normal. And especially given the races I don't do well at, it's kind of weird that it is as high as it is. But so he helped me recognize both what my limitations were, but also what my gifts were. And he, even though he was a decathlete, he understands physiology. And so he's like, hey, like if you train right, like if you got your threshold higher, you could use your VO2 max and it could actually like do some things. And so like, so train to like be able to extend your threshold for as long as possible. I was like, cool. Every run I've ever done is a threshold run. I can do that. And so, so we started talking about what we needed to do differently. And so, he helped me kind of begin to start thinking along those lines, but I mean, I'm still figuring it out. But he set me down that road of kind of tailoring training to myself. Like, cause I know that that most of the athletes that I work with aren't me. They don't have that high of VO2 max and they may not have the weaknesses that I have either. And so it's like, learn how to do this. And then I've been fortunate to have some other mentors along the way that have helped me kind of fine tune that and refine that approach.
So, so Jacob, like that being said, you know, I think that every runner, every person out there has an event specific self. I mean, you know, like you take Zach Bitter, you know, he's built for 100 miles. He just is. He's tried the 24 hour a couple times and he doesn't do well and he doesn't do great at that shorter 50K, 50 mile type stuff. But, you know, everybody's got, you know, an event specific best. Would you say yours is a 50 mile or 50K?
I would say somewhere between probably 3 and 6 hours. And so yeah, most of the time that would be 50K to 50 miles. I'm not great at technical stuff. One, I have like really big feet and I didn't grow up running technical stuff. Like I grew up in farmland. So like trail running to me was running on the canal road next to the service road next to the canal. So dirt roads are trails to me. I like running on like buffed out trails, but I like training on stuff that's kind of exciting to explore, but I don't view that as like, I don't enjoy it. Like I don't like racing when I don't feel like I can race, when I feel like I'm fumbling and like I'm not at my best. That's not my wheelhouse. That's not my skill set. And so I enjoy that as an adventure or a challenge, but not as a, like, this is my goal race. This is what I'm preparing for. Yeah. So
I just want to hear about this because I think this Dave is a good treadmill runner, right? He's got a couple world records himself. Zach took one of them away this year. So we're going to egg him on to go back and see if he can beat him.
I think you should do it, Jacob. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've run on the treadmill a lot. I think most people don't like running on the treadmill, and especially to try to do something for 5 hours.
Yeah.
And so how did, tell us a little bit about, you know, that 5 hours, or it was of course less than 5 hours, but excuse me, was it hard from the beginning? Did you find, was the pace, you know, really, you know, locked in and it was hard but doable, or was it like towards the end holding on for dear life?
So I think part of why running on a treadmill is okay for me is because I did grow up in a place that doesn't have, I find it beautiful, but most people don't find it beautiful. I mean, I live 10 kilometers from Banff National Park. I mean, like I live in one of the most beautiful places in the world. And I don't care if I have to run on a treadmill some days. And I don't care if I like to me, it's not like, oh, I can't go run the new trail and I can't post a pretty picture on Instagram because of the views. And I'm not mocking people who feel that way. It's just, that's not the way I was raised. Like I was raised running in the dark in the morning or delivering papers in the dark as a little kid and stuff like that. And, born on a farm where there's chores and stuff like that. So like, you can't even see half the stuff that like, you know, so part of it is just like feeling, I feel like I'm maybe just naturally more intuitive and I'm grateful for that because it kind of taught me how to listen to my body from a very young age, both by running in the dark, but also, I think maybe it's the analytical piece too. Like I love running circles around a track. Like at some point I want to go run a track race. Like my favorite workouts of all time are going and just like hammering out intervals. They don't have to be at VO2 max, but like, I like critical velocity. Like, so you're kind of between that threshold and that VO2 max, and just, I've done like 50 of them at like, when I'm training for a marathon, like it doesn't make sense, but that I love doing that kind of stuff. So I think I'm just wired that way. And I think some people are and some aren't, but I've never associated with running or even feeling good as a runner with kind of needing a visual distraction to keep you going. I usually get annoyed when I try and like watch something on my phone or even listen to stuff half the time. I'm just like, my phone won't work, or I'm trying to watch a movie on Netflix. And finally I just like give up and I'm like, screw it. Just like, so I, even though I have the apps and stuff like that, and sometimes I can run along with my brother on iFit, half the time I'm like, I don't have the time to mess around with this. And so I run in the track mode still, you know, and I don't care. It's whatever. I really don't care. Even though I have a nice treadmill that does other, it has the fancy bells and whistles. I don't care.
Not a lot of Strava segments.
I don't even know how that works. Like every once in a while I get a usually on Strava, I either get a notification saying so-and-so stole this from you. And I was like, where's that? I don't even know what that is. Or you just got this, or I get like a dirty email or a message, like someone tags me like, how dare you? And it's like, where was that? I don't even know where it is. So I don't even know how to hunt for segments. And my stuff's automatically up. Like my watch talks to my phone and they just sync. And
right.
I'm that guy that gets flagged for riding his bike when it should have been a run and that kind of thing.
Because
I didn't pay attention to that. So
Yeah. People get pretty uppity about that, right? So So Jacob, I'm a lot like you. Like I can lock out, kind of lock into my brain and just go. And I sense that you're very much the same as I am. But you know, I know with my treadmill, world record attempts, there was a point that it got hard. It was a point that you go, ooh, okay, this is becoming a big effort, right? And there are no distractions around. During the 50 mile, when was that? Was it right around that marathon mark? When did things start to get hard?
To be honest, like the first couple hours were probably the hardest because I wanted to run as slow as possible and still get the record. Not because that was my goal, but it was just like, okay, here's the record. And I just want to make sure that I pace myself. And I have a tendency to go out too hard and blow up. And so I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure I can lock in on this pace and then, and get that, like just run slightly faster than what the record is and dig when I need to. And I started at that pace. And I think that was closer to 7 minutes a mile, was what I was going to need. And within like 30 to 40 minutes, like my knees were hitting the front of the treadmill and I was just like, I can't do this. Like it was nice to like, to warm up, but it just didn't feel natural. It wasn't what I wanted to be doing. And it wasn't because people were around or anything like that. That wasn't the day. I think it's also fair to say that like, my dad surfed a bit when he was a younger child, or a young man. And the way he describes it is like, you know, he spent a long time trying to catch that perfect wave. And on that day I caught the perfect wave. Like there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I think you might be able to say that. Yeah, I had to grind and stuff like that, but man, the stars aligned that day too. It was just like, I was going to get that record. I knew I was going to get the record, period. Like I was pretty confident that like come hell or high water, I was going to get the record, but I didn't even have any like fantasies about going under 5 hours or so I felt really good. But the worst parts were like finding that rhythm. It took a couple hours. It took about a marathon to warm up and to like actually feel like, okay, I can actually stretch my legs out. And then once I was willing to accept like, hey, you're more than halfway done and it's okay to lock in at 6 minute pace, this is what feels natural, do it. And then after a while it actually felt more natural to like go faster. And it was just like, all right. And it wasn't because like, yeah, the last hour, last 30 minutes, it was like, yeah, this is hurting. I want to get done. But like for that 3 to 4, even 3 to 4.5 hours, it was like, there were a couple like 5 minute intervals in there, like where I was like doing a fart, like kind of thing, but it was kind of just like stretch my legs out and go. And it wasn't because I was trying to show off or anything. It was just like, this is awesome. Like this feels great. And I want to just run with it. And I didn't know if I was going to go for 80K or for 100K or for 6 hours or what I had a couple different goals along the way. And then when I realized that I was like going to do pretty well at the 50 mile distance, I was like, let's just go as like, I'm going to get it. So let's just see how much I can get it from. And then that's when I just kind of like, just went as hard as I could for as long as I could. And then was okay to say like, yep, I'm going to shut it down as soon as it hits 50 miles. Mm-hmm. So
you knew that was the moment. You know, it's actually been pretty interesting distance this past year or two, right? And that you got Jim Walmsley and, you know, JFK run, and then lots of guys are charging around that 5 hour mark and 50 miles. It seems almost crazy, right? When you think about that kind of speed, you know, becoming almost not, we want to call it normal, but something people can go out and target. It's just to keep that going for that period of time, it's just incredible. So you know, kudos to you for, what year did you do the record?
I think that was in 2006. Yeah, so it was shortly after I moved to Canada at the end of 2015. And so part of the rationale or the justification for doing it was that I needed a treadmill. I hadn't experienced winter quite like we do here. And so I needed a treadmill, and my wife was looking on Kijiji or the Canadian equivalent of Craigslist. And I was like, sorry. Like I'm super frugal about a lot of things. I'm not going to like buy a used broken treadmill, mostly because I know how that's like my worst skill set is being anything mechanical. So I was like, I'm not fixing the thing. And those things are huge. And so you bring something in and it's broken. You don't even realize it's broken until you set it up, or you break it while setting it up or while moving it. Like then you're stuck with it. And then you have to get, if the only people you know are runners, that's like an entire team to move.
Yeah. We're not big muscular men. No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I was like, no, we're going to get the right one. We're going to have it delivered and maybe even assembled like so that it works right. And so it worked out that the parent company of Altra at the time also owns a number of treadmill companies. And so I just reached out to my contacts at Altra and said, hey, is there a way that we can kind of promote this stuff? And will you hook me up with a treadmill if I do?
That's nice.
And it worked out. So yeah.
And so now you're out coaching, you're running. Do you have any yourself, you know, big goals you're shooting for?
Man, this last year was rough. I wanted to go back and run Boston again. This is odd. So the treadmill that I ran the record on and that I received as part of my compensation for that was it's called a Boston Marathon treadmill. And so, part of the deal when I got some publicity for doing it, I didn't even realize anyone would care. I just wanted a treadmill. But when people started paying attention, they asked like, so what do you want to do? And I was like, you know what? I've never run Boston. And like, I was never able to, cause I was a school teacher and I couldn't take the time off to fly to the East Coast, and Patriots Day is only a holiday in Massachusetts, not the rest of the world. So it just didn't work out. And so I finally quit doing that and coaching full time. And so I was like, you know what? I want to run the Boston Marathon. Like, that's like the question you get as a mm-hmm. runner. It either, have you run Boston or are you training for the Olympics? And it's like, haven't done either and probably not going to. And then I was like, you know what? I could run Boston. And so anyway, I was able to run Boston. It was a hot year and I trained mostly on a treadmill. And so I'd actually like to run Boston this year if it happens in September, because I think it'd be fun to train during the summer and see what I could do with some decent weather. So
April, I've done the Boston 5 times and the weather is completely different every time.
Yeah. From Wednesday. Both there and here. Yeah. Yeah.
80 something degrees once. And there were like thousands of people got heat stroke. And then what was it? 2018 when it was freezing rain and coldest I've ever
absolutely.
Met. Your Des Linden one, and it was a survival day. You know, I remember one of the elites dropped out. Women elites dropped out at mile 25. Like that's when you know it's a bad day, when you're 1 mile from the finish and you can't even finish.
Yeah,
but that's what's so fun about Boston. It's probably the most fun marathon to run, I think, because the people are just crazy excited to see you come by, and no matter what the weather.
And I wasn't prepared for that. And I want to go there better prepared for the course and better prepared for like, I like repetition kind of probably why I like the treadmill. So I kind of want to go back and see what I can do. Like I felt like I had the Boston experience and I was really happy with the way things turned out. but I'd like to like go back better prepared to like even just handle the emotions of the crowd and stuff like that. Like that was, it was overwhelming in some places. I was like, are you kidding me? Like when you go by some students, you're getting like a big puff of weed smoke, and then you go by others and you're getting kisses and stuff like that. I was like, okay, I need to know how to navigate which side of the road to run on and stuff like that. So yeah.
Running up Heartbreak Hill, a couple of smiles will really get you up the hill pretty good.
For sure.
It's, yeah. We got to get Dave out there one of these days too. It's definitely on the bucket list of marathons if there was to be one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah. So, Jacob.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. Please go ahead.
I don't have a lot of bucket list races. Boston is still one, even though I've run it. And I would probably say Western States and Comrades are probably the only other two that I think are on there. I don't mean to offend anyone who I'm friends with at race directs and stuff like that, but those are the ones that like, that I still really want to do. And maybe like Javelina, cause I think I love the heat. I grew up in the desert and I love the Southwest. And I really like Arvaipa and what Jamil's doing there. Yeah. And so I think that would be fun. And the party atmosphere, just like the community fun thing, maybe not right now, with everything, but someday I think Javelina would be fun to do, and Western States, and Comrades, maybe both ways, just cause you know,
I did the Javelina 100, and it is it's a fun race, and it's that if you're in a good, you know, for you probably, you know, could really enjoy, because there's a little bit of, it's not too hard of a race, and you can really run it. Comrades is a phenomenal, if for you that's probably great because it's mostly road, and then who wouldn't want to run Western States, right? That's a you got a good list to work on. The good thing is you got time, right? This is one good thing about our sport, is that we don't sort of age out too soon. We can still have some fun out there.
Yeah, and in this year, in 2020, you know, there's just a lot going on. We're gifted with time, aren't we, Jacob? So, I mean, this year has been I know really, really, you know, a challenge for you and your family, and looking out for your brother. And you know, it was just really great to check in with you, Jacob. And and seeing what's next for you and your family and your racing and your coaching and on and so forth. So we want to thank you so much for being a part of the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. And we're going to have you back on when you're on the podium at the Boston Marathon in 2021. How about that?
Well, I like that idea, but I'm realistic. I don't ever anticipate being on the podium at Boston. But yeah, I mean, honestly, that's the cool part about Boston, is I think everyone who runs Boston feels like they're on the podium at just about any race. Like it's a pretty extraordinary experience to see. It's like the one time when, as a runner, you feel like a rock star. it's pretty awesome. But everyone in the race gets to feel that way. And so I want to go back, kind of prepared to reciprocate a little bit more. Like I felt like I went and I took and I absorbed a lot of really positive energy. I want to go back and thank people and just enjoy the full experience with some sense of what to be prepared for. But yeah, that is the beauty of our sport. There's a lot that we can do, and we can do it. Hopefully if we do it smart, we can do it for a long time. And so I have goals to do this forever, so hope I can.
We love that. Well, we'll be out here rooting for you, and you know, good luck finishing up the year, and we'll see you out on the road next year. And thanks for being on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jacob.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, Dave, it seems just about impossible to believe anyone can run that fast. 4:57 for 50 miles? I mean, 4 hours and 57 minutes. I mean, that's reasonably an okay marathon time. I mean, and with that kind of understated start to running, it seems even more improbable that he was able to accomplish that. But I guess that's what a VO2 max of 80 really does for you. When you push it and set out to do big things, it responds nicely. I imagine he would be a great coach for all that he's been through. Well, there you have it. That's a wrap for this week. As always, a big shout out to our sponsor, Performance Tea. You can find them at www.performancetea.com, and they have given us a discount code for all of our listeners to get 20% off their purchase. Just use Chasing20 to get the discount. If you have a topic or guest you'd like to see, email us your ideas at info@chasingtomorrowpodcast.com. And a huge thanks to our listeners for coming with us on this journey and chasing tomorrow with us. Thanks very much.